Hello, and welcome to a roundtable discussion on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo. In this episode, I'm joined by guests for a lively conversation on a topic we hope you'll find interesting. So we've just finished watching Star Trek of Gods and Men, which is a fan film for Star Trek. This is interesting to me because the person who did the story and did the directing is Tim Russ, who played Tuvok.
And by fan film, we should mention it's in the crowdfunded realm.
Fan film is probably the wrong term. Independent film is probably a better term. Certainly crowdfunded is accurate. But this is one that... again, Tim Russ, who played Tuvok for, what, 7 seasons on Voyager?
Yeah.
Was in, was actually the instigator of behind the scenes or whatever. It starred Nichelle Nichols, Uhura, Walter Koenig, Chekhov.
Alan Ruck.
Alan Ruck, who played John Harriman from the Generations movie where we lost Kirk and stuff. This is taking place 12 years after that. It also had a number of other actors who've been in the various Star Trek franchises. Some from the original series, a couple from the Amok Time episode. We had the one who played Yeoman Ran.
Grace Whitney.
Grace Lee Whitney. This was her, I think, final TV appearance. TV, it's again, more
hard
internet.
To sum up. Yeah. And to clarify that, it was distributed via YouTube for most people.
Yeah. And this was done back in 2008.
Yeah.
So it's a few years old, first time we've seen it. And it had, again, a number of other people, Garrett Wang from Voyager.
Sirik Lofton from DS9.
He had a small role in there. Ethan Phillips, who played Neelix. The one from Alien Nation, whose name I'm blanking on.
Gary Graham?
Gary Graham. He was in it quite a bit. Basically, I mean, they had just, and Chase Masterson from Deep Space Nine.
J.G. Hertzler, who is a frequent Klingon.
He is probably the only one of the bunch, really, to have been on Next Generation.
I think you're right.
Because most of these people were more either original series or Voyager or a Deep Space Nine. So, not much even by way of Enterprise at that point.
Agreed.
Was Enterprise still on the air at this point, 2008? Was it even before? Well,
no.
Gary Graham would count for Enterprise.
Yes, he would. And I was thinking Enterprise was off the air by this point, but I would have to check to confirm that.
In most cases, these people played different roles, with the exception of Uhura, Chekhov, Stan, again from Amok Time, Grace Lee Whitney's character,
Janice Rand.
Janice Rand. They played the same characters. Many of these others just played different people.
Yeah. Enterprise was on from 2001 to 2005.
Okay, so it was over for a couple of years.
And like Sirik Lofton was Uhura's grandson, or son. Sorry, son.
In an altered timeline.
Yeah. And that was very interesting. So many of these movies and things like to do the alternate timeline. There were aspects of the costuming that reminded me of the Mirror Universe.
The basic premise of this, and again, spoilers galore here, is that a Enterprise 1701M for museum is being put together. It's the original style Enterprise. It's going out. They get a call to basically the planet of the Guardian of Forever. So they, of course, go racing along to that. Charlie X is there from that episode. He goes back in time, removes Kirk from the equation, and then we get this altered timeline. Now, what I loved about the altered timeline is the command uniform, silver.
Yes.
Versus gold. There were aspects, again, of Garrett Wang's character, his costume, very reminiscent, again, of the Mirror Universe. It's a darker universe, and just it really shows kind of the impact Kirk had, both directly and indirectly. Not having been there to stop Gary Mitchell and stuff like that. And they went to pretty serious lengths to recreate the bridge of the Enterprise, a lot of the key locations, obviously the corridors, the conference room, the transporter room, never see med bay or
sick bay.
Sick bay. We never see
engineering
is the other one.
We have a scene in the brig. We don't have Bones, but we get his classic exchange.
They reference a couple of lines of dialogue that are very reminiscent of the original stuff. And they address where Kirk is, Spock, and you know, again, after Kirk, but we get his nephew, McCoy. They address the other people.
Yeah.
And as much as Pavel Chekhov was a lead character here, really, this story was an Uhura story.
It was. And I really enjoyed it in terms of, right from the moment we pick up with her in this alternate timeline, I liked that she was on Vulcan.
I liked she was on Vulcan. I liked she was still her.
Yeah.
The linguist, the person who pushes some of the boundaries, but not disrespectfully so.
Very much in a, I want to understand, why is this the belief? Why is this the way I should think? Why is this the logical option? And not skip to the end, but...
But you're gonna...
Well, because she's the one who, when the timeline alters, she remembers it.
Yes.
To some degree. And there again at the end, she has some memory of what changed, what was so bad while it was changed. But she also remembers what was good in the alternate timeline.
There's an aspect at the end where they bring it full circle. And what worked for her in the alternate timeline, marrying Staan, which is the Vulcan and the same actor from the Amok Time episode where Spock is fighting on Vulcan. And the one who Staan later married there actually is the priestess who does the wedding at the end of this movie. And, you know, it's one of those things. It was a really strong story.
Mm-hmm.
I think they could have explained the dash M on the Enterprise at the beginning.
Yes, I wish they had.
Because that threw me out for a bit. It's like, well, dash D is next gen, so how could this be an M, implying it was a letter? And if it, you know, if they just started that with a dash M for museum, haha, you know, kind of would have been nice. But they nailed the look of the show. Again, they had the actors on up and down, so they had the same quality there. And the kind of story, it's a Star Trek story. It felt true to the stuff. And really, so far as a swan song for the Uhura character, I can't really imagine anything better. And Nichelle Nichols knocked it out of the park here. Yeah. Just did a great job.
Yeah.
I thought Walter Koenig did a very good job of Chekhov, but in the alter timeline where we spent most of the movie, he was a very darker and different character. He was still Chekhov. But one who'd gone down a very unfortunate path.
Yeah, he was one that had aspects of Kirk's plot lines from the
second movie when his son died.
Yeah.
Yeah, there were some parallels there. I hadn't really picked up on that until you just mentioned it now. But I can definitely see that. I mean, Chekhov lost his wife, his son, his paradise.
Well, I was going to say, they even had the New Eden and that aspect, which, as I recall, is where Kirk's son was and everything.
Well, and the Omega device that they used to blow up planets in here was evocative of the Genesis device. Just, again, a darker version of it.
Yeah.
So I hadn't, again, made those parallels, but I definitely see them now. I liked how they had the older style movie era phasers. That was a nice touch. And there was a lot of ship combat, fire, you know, dogfighting kind of a thing. And there were a few times where it got a little confusing to me as to which ships were fighting and what they were doing. Because there was, at one point, dozens of ships involved.
Yeah, there were two fleets involved. There were times when ships were flying sideways and doing loop-de-loops and going upside down that kind of made me wonder.
I was more okay with that than a couple of times we had things that looked like they were clearly towing something somewhere.
Yeah.
There was some aspects of all of that that really just kind of confused me a bit.
There was a glowing ball of pieces. I was never sure what was.
Yeah, it looked like a Borg sphere covered in Christmas lights.
Yeah.
So, There were a few things there that fell flat, but there were other parts where some of the effects they did, again, for a crowd-funded project, really mm-hmm. well done.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the transporter effect was good. All the ship stuff was good. When they used the phasers and whatnot, and the Guardian of Forever effect was well done.
They never named the Guardian of Forever incomplete.
I don't think they necessarily can.
Yeah.
Because of the Harlan Ellison stuff. But they also credited Harlan Ellison as being one of the inspirations for this sort of thing.
Yeah. And I thought that was just an interesting line they end up walking.
But there are a lot of these sorts of crowd-funded web series for Star Trek and whatnot, just because it's been, a decade since we've had a Star Trek series.
Mm-hmm.
Now, again, we've got another one on the horizon about a year or so out.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm definitely looking forward to that.
Yeah.
But this has me wanting to go check out a few of the other projects.
Mm-hmm. Now, this was done by the same people who did Star Trek Renegades, which we saw a panel for at Con.
Yes.
And it's part of why, not that I was sitting here thinking, oh, I bet the plots are intertwined or something, but I wanted to see their first effort before I saw their second effort.
Yeah, I wanted to see them in order, if for no other reason than the effects of the special, progression of the special effects.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of talk, because Renegades is like a pilot movie and then a couple of episodes or something.
Mm-hmm.
And at least one of those episodes is going to essentially be Walter Koenig's kind of swan song for Chekhov.
Interesting.
And I'm getting, you know, I'm on the email list for that. And they're saying it may be the last time an original actor from the original series plays their original character, you know, almost ever or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I'm really glad Nichelle Nichols got the opportunity to do that with Uhura here
mm-hmm.
on Of Gods and Men.
Yeah, it was a beautiful plot line for the Uhura character.
Well, she was a strong character. She was very instrumental in saving the day,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it was very respectful of the past of the series,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
you know, even going to kind of sort of referencing the interracial kiss or whatever, just again with the marriage at the end to the mm-hmm. Vulcan and stuff. There's an aspect where, yeah, that makes sense for her character to have done that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and it's easy, I think, for a fan Star Trek project or an independent Star Trek project like this to be done, to kind of fall off the rails,
mm-hmm.
miss the mark of what the true vision was, or, you know, how dark do you go? How dark do you not go? How much mm-hmm. action, you know? Because, mm-hmm. I mean, there's you can even look at the rebooted Star Trek films. I mean, they're more action than cerebral.
Mm-hmm.
And there's nothing wrong. They're great films.
When, on the one hand, you know, could the script have used polishing? Yeah. But on the other hand, this script had a lot of good meat and content behind it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the overriding question of the whole film really is, how much of a difference does one man make?
Yes.
Or can one man make?
It's the importance of the individual.
Mm-hmm. You know, and alongside that question, they're actively asking the question of, should you always put the good of the many ahead of the good of the few? Who decides what the good of the many is
mm-hmm.
versus the good of the few and these things? And they both address them in the dialogue, but also they address them with the action and with the plot lines.
Well, and it goes back to, that's the sort of premise or issue that a classic Star Trek episode would have had.
Mm-hmm.
You know, who gets to decide what's the greater good or whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And the let history be the judge kind of speech that Uhura has is the sort of thing I very easily could have seen Kirk giving in the mm-hmm. original series.
Yeah.
Or Picard later, or, you know,
mm-hmm.
Any of the other captains or lead characters.
Yeah.
So the fact that it rang true in that respect, to me, gave them a lot of, I don't want to say leeway, but a lot of credibility.
Yeah.
And the fact that the ship looked as it should have looked.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it felt like an original Trek layout for the bridge and whatnot.
Yeah.
Without being slavishly so or kind of cheesy or dated.
Mm-hmm.
And that's tough to pull off.
It is.
there was an aspect of the, I don't know if it was the lighting or something, but it was clear that they're working on, again, they're not a major, you know, studio like Paramount or something like that. They did a great job. There was no problems with the lighting. It felt right, but it was more basic lighting than, I mean, because you go back to first season of Next Gen, certainly some of the earlier, the original series and whatnot, and there was much more dramatic mood lighting or whatever, almost distractingly so at times.
Yeah.
But there was an aspect here where having more resources to throw at the project, I think they could have done a better job on just some of the production values. But that having been said, I want to be clear, this was well above acceptable. This is well done.
Oh, yeah.
This was not just a couple of people with a camcorder or something. So they did a great job in that respect. But it also comes down to starting with a really good story, knowing who the characters are, getting the right actors for those characters, using some of the Star Trek actors in different roles. Again, Chase Masterson as an Orion slave girl slash comm officer was nice. Kira Clifton as the son of Uhura in the altered timeline. Those things were kind of nice. And just not trying to cash in on Star Trek, but to extend a Star Trek.
Yeah.
And again, given the people involved, Tim Russ, etc., I'm not the least bit surprised.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, I was very curious about Renegades, having seen the crowdfunding campaign and such, having gone to the panels at the convention, and now having seen their previous work, it's like, they're doing a good job. And particularly with Chekhov's character, we're, again, going to get that last portrayal of him. This is the creative team behind the scenes. I feel comfortable that he'll get a really good send-off.
Yeah.
You know, because there have been a couple in the past where, I mean, even Scotty's on Next Gen was good, but it was a Scotty episode of Next Gen, not a Scotty episode. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
So, again, they've got free rein to a large degree because they can do whatever kind of they want to within the bounds of what they feel is right, acceptable, and won't get them sued by Paramount. And let's give a lot of credit to Paramount, to CBS, to the actual property holders for Star Trek for letting this sort of thing be done.
Agreed. Yes.
Because these people arguably, I mean, they're not infringing on the property, but they're certainly going beyond what could have been considered fair use. And really, they're keeping the property very much alive in many respects in a respectable way. Without, I think, directly competing with the feature films, the comics, the books, whatever. And I think the companies, again, Paramount, CBS, et cetera, allowing this to happen is a really smart move long term.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
And even short term, it's galvanizing the fan interest versus squashing it.
Yeah.
And it's also a way for them to, frankly, keep an eye on, this guy's doing some good writing. This guy's doing some good effects. Set guy, you know, we may use him.
Yeah.
If when they're doing this new Star Trek show, they haven't at least taken a look at these projects and considered tapping some of those resources. The one who does, I'm forgetting if it's Star Trek Phase 2 or whatever. It's Vic Montagno or whatever. Another web series that I saw on YouTube that was basically doing, okay, you've seen this classic episode, like the mirror one. Here's what happens right afterwards.
Oh, funny.
And in the mirror one, it's all taking place in the mirror universe. After that scene with Spock, mirror Spock and Kirk, where Kirk's like, is this logical? Whatever. The story picks up on that side. Complete with reshooting that scene. And again, they've done really well. And in that one, Sulu is played by the Mythbuster, Grant Imahara.
Funny.
Well, he's a geek. He's Star Trek, you know, whatever. And there's aspects on some of that with it being almost impressions of the classic actors. Whereas here we had the classic actors in many cases in the same role, some in others. But, you know, that was the other one. Was really cool to see how they extended the specific stories. Here, how we've seen the timeline play out. And again, it makes that classic Star Trek universe all the richer.
Yes.
You know, and frankly, you know, keep some of these actors in front of the camera, getting that fan base, continuing that kind of thing. It allows the actors to give back to the fans as the fans are giving back to the property.
Yeah.
It's kind of a virtuous cycle in many respects. And I've got to imagine that was these sorts of projects or the sort of thing that hopefully led to the series we're going to get 2017. There's an interest.
Yeah. I was going to say there's a part of me that thinks so. When you think about how many of these, especially Star Trek properties or projects, are happening right now.
There's a ton.
Axanar, Renegades.
Axanar, yeah.
Captain Pike.
Yeah, I've helped on the crowdfunding for Captain Pike. Again, Renegades, like you mentioned, Axanar, I think I've chipped in on that. There's a ton of them. And I really appreciate that they're able to, and this goes also to the Screen Actors Guild, and some thanks here.
Yes.
To modifying their rules or doing whatever they needed to do to where these actors can do these projects.
Mm-hmm.
Without bankrupting the project, impacting their scale on more, I don't say more legitimate projects, but you know what I mean.
Yeah,
more
exactly.
Standard projects. And the whole new media agreement and stuff here is, I mean, it's groundbreaking, and we're getting some really good stuff coming out of this. And it opens the doors to other properties potentially getting this same sort of resurgence.
Yeah.
There's nothing to say that a group of dedicated people couldn't do a new Stargate series, web series or series of movies or whatnot. Or I'm trying to think what other shows. But, I mean, anything from the past, I mean, for that matter, you know, be it a like a Mission Impossible, which is another Paramount kind of a deal. I'm just trying to think what has a big enough fan base. And again, Stargate would be the one that pops to my mind. It would also be really fun if not only some of those sorts of projects got off the ground, but if they were to cross over with some of these Star Trek type properties. You know, there's nothing to say that they couldn't do, provided, again, the property owners are willing to let such fan creations happen. There couldn't be a crossover, which could be a lot of fun.
Agreed.
You know, the technology available to those of us not in the Hollywood, you know, production companies, both with just video, special effects type capabilities on home computers and whatnot, is just, it's increasing every day. And the nice thing with this, again, 2008, we're watching it in 2015. There are a few things, it's like, okay, maybe they could have done a little better here or there, but nothing that felt cheesy, dated, or bad.
Agreed.
I mean, to me, the spaceship battles were well done, decently choreographed, just not well explained.
Yeah. Well, and that goes back to there were two large fleets involved.
Yes.
And at least one ship changed sides.
Yes. And I think there was another ship that looked an awful lot like it.
Yes. And that just confused things further.
Yeah. I think in that respect, they would have done better here not having the large fleets, keeping things more manageable with just three or four ships that looked very different, were very clear, and continually cutting back to the bridges of those ships as they're shouting the orders.
Yeah.
You know, fire phasers, hit the photons, get the shields, you know, whatever. Now, I will say the bit at the end when the ship on the bad guy's side is about to fire the Omega device to blow up the planet, that Chekhov and Harriman on the equivalent of the Enterprise, their plan to you know, with no engines and minimal maneuverability, whatever, to kind of block the shot. Really well done.
Yeah.
It was clearly told. It was good effects. And I love the bit when they pull out the saucer separation.
Yes.
You know, when Walter Koenig, you know, is doing the, if only Scotty were here, followed beat, beat, aha. Let me think like Scotty. Because Scotty was Chekhov's mentor in many respects. So there were moments there that having actors of this caliber, actors this ingrained in the character, were just really able to sell.
Yeah.
And frankly, it was also a bit of a redemption for Alan Ruck's character of Captain John Harriman.
Yeah.
Because he did not come off all that well in Generations. He's the guy who killed Kirk.
Yeah.
Could have done a little better at the beginning of this establishing Kirk's nephew.
Yes.
And I felt Uhura and Chekhov should have known the nephew
mm-hmm.
a little better. Establish, hey, you know, how exactly is he Kirk's nephew? It's his brother, it's his, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it was no worse than establishing Damora Sulu in Generations as Sulu's daughter.
Yeah.
With the, how did he have the time?
You know, magic things happen off camera.
Apparently. When you're on a 5-year mission away, though, kind of hard to have the kid. Anyways.
Magic things.
Yeah. I also thought the use of tablets and whatnot as stand-ins for the controls for, like, the transporter room.
Yes.
Was well done.
Yeah.
So kudos to the tech team behind this for that. I mean, just all the way around, it was a good production.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to see not only Renegades, but what else has Tim Russ been working on?
That's an excellent question.
So maybe our listeners, if they're aware of other similar Trek fan films, they can post those with hopefully links on the forum.
That'd be great.
And just kind of a, is this worth watching or not? Because I'll be honest, I've seen a couple on YouTube, a few of which were computer generated, and a few of which were very heavy on the compositing, and the compositing was not really well done, that it was more amateur level.
Yeah.
And this, again, was not. It was well produced.
Well, I will try to say with a straight face that Tim Russ was in Sharknado 3. He did an episode of Night Shift. I was thinking
more in terms of
yeah.
this sort of project than just where is he guested.
Let's see. Director. He's got a few things in pre and post production that I can't tell what they are. He's directed the pilot for Star Trek Renegades.
That makes sense.
Directed 21 episodes of something called Bloomers. A lot of things I'm not recognizing, and they say videos and shorts.
Those are what this would fall into, I guess. And it comes down to, it probably takes quite a bit of time to get the project put together for the writing, the sets, the production, the crowdfunding.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to be doing these necessarily every couple of days.
Yeah.
You know, although hopefully with Renegades kind of up and going, and I think they've partnered with one or two other groups that are doing similar sort of Star Trek things for shared resources on the bridge and stuff like that, which I think is a win-win strategy.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
So, Star Trek of Gods and Men, you should be able to find it on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's well worth checking out, particularly if you're a fan of Uhura.
Yes.
Again, we've got Chekhov, we've got Harriman, we've got Hertzler, I think, was reprising a role as the particular Klingon.
Koval,
but it was an alternate timeline version.
Yeah.
So, I think it's well worth checking out. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
So, anything else on this?
No, I'm ready to watch more Trek.
Cool. So we've just finished watching Star Trek Renegades. I guess technically it's episode 1 now.
Yeah, and that surprised me. It is a standalone movie. Let's start with that fact. I mean, it...
What it is another Kickstarter Indiegogo Star Trek project.
Mm-hmm.
This has a lot of recognizable people in it. Notably, Tim Russ reprising as Tuvok, Walter Koenig as Chekhov, Robert Picardo as
Zimmerman,
not as the EMH.
Mm-hmm.
And it's essentially kind of sort of a standalone movie, but I would consider it more of like a pilot episode.
Wait.
Assemble a team and they're going to have a continued adventure.
It definitely has the, you know, these people can go off and do things, but if they did nothing else, you'd be fine.
It ended on a note with the expectation is they will do something else.
Yes.
I think if they had decided not to do that, they could have tweaked the final scene and given it a sense of closure.
There are things that I wish they'd done at the end of the movie, whether it's a pilot or a standalone.
This is one where they had a number of very talented actors.
Yes.
And Robert Picardo is always fun to watch. Corin Nemec from Parker Lewis Can't Lose and Stargate, among other things, had a role. He's a very talented actor.
Mm-hmm.
Tim Russ, you know, Walter Koenig. They had Gary Graham. They had a number of other people.
Sean Young.
Sean, yeah. So a lot of people that are not just, oh, they do web stuff. I mean, legitimate actors who've been on TV series, been leads on TV series.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And Gary Graham on Alien Nation.
Yes.
Again, he did stuff on Voyager. And they had representation from, I would say, most of the shows, the exception probably being Next Generation.
Yeah.
Because they had somebody from Voyager, somebody from, did they have anyone from Deep Space Nine? Anyways, from a lot of the different parts of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a fan film, so there are places where the effects are a little, well, they're walking in front of a green screen. But there were also places where the effects were phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
When they were great, they were truly great.
Mm-hmm.
When they were, they were still pretty good.
There were a few places, though, where you're sitting there going, you know, folks, you could make that as a backdrop or a desktop for people's computers and put that up as one of your rewards in the Kickstarter and the Indiegogo for the low amounts. And I think people would be thrilled.
Yeah. I wish they had spent a little bit more time establishing the layout of the Icarus.
Mm.
We see the bridge, we see the meeting room, really not much else.
Yeah.
And it didn't feel like a Federation ship, although it's a stolen Federation ship. And the writing, though, is where I think, while it had some moments, that was the weak part of this.
Yeah, I'm afraid so.
There were a number of places where characters had very forced exposition dialogue to get their backstory out there.
Mm-hmm.
The doc, when she is having the hologram conversation with Zimmerman, he knows her entire backstory, but she feels the need to put it out there as awkwardly and stilted as possible. And I don't blame the actress.
No, not at all. It's what the script gave them. She did really well in
some other stuff. It's just, this has to get put out there and blah, it's there.
Yeah.
And there were a number of places where things were told and not shown.
Well, and the flip side to that is they relied so heavily on trying to show what the arch enemy aliens culture was. And I kept asking you questions about it. And you were saying, well, they're trying to be sort of a warrior Klingon race. And they were so heavy on the trying to show it that they didn't tell me enough. And I didn't understand them.
That's funny because I would agree with you entirely. There's aspects of there's some kind of rite of first kill or last kill and
your things, sacrifice will be honored or something to that effect.
Things of that culture that are implied and kind of danced around. But like at one point, he's going to kill the captain. Somebody else steps in and gets killed in her place. And he's like, well, now I can't kill her.
You ruined the fight and this death won't benefit me.
And it's like, great. How come?
Yeah.
And that's the sort of thing. Fine. Have somebody have uncovered some researcher or that's one where a scene back on the ship with a, well, you know, somebody saying, well, I'm confused. Well, you know, maybe their race is like this. Maybe their culture is whatever. Or mm-hmm. We dug it up in the archives.
They needed a character in the show and maybe the Betazoid was the right character to go with for this, who either had a knack for figuring out cultures, pursued information about them because she wanted to understand the enemy they were going to go up against, or would go into the archives and figure things out.
I think it would have been interesting to have somebody like the Betazoid, a race of empaths and telepaths, but have somebody else who's the sociologist.
Well, and Ichab might have been the right one to do it.
Maybe, but basically play up the, yes, you feel, you sense, but you don't understand.
Mm-hmm.
I don't need to see this. I can just see the interaction, and this is the
mm-hmm.
the alpha. This is, you know, whatever the dynamic is.
Well, I can see Ichab being the one to do the research because he has so little firsthand experience and so little understanding.
Yeah.
But he's so computer-oriented coming from that Borg background.
Well, and it was funny because he's got a robotic arm kind of thing that is oddly human at times, oddly, you know, really armored at times. And they phrase, oh, they've turned me into a weapon. Again, another part of very stilted, mm-hmm. forced exposition. But It's like, well, kind of how else do you put some of this into one 80-minute or so episode? So they had some challenges there. But when he's going in the caverns and stuff, he's got the arm, and it's got a display that he's sitting there reading. And it's like, he's Borg.
Yeah.
He should just know these things. Now, display it for other people, sure. But, yeah, that didn't work for me. The Betazoid, who had a genetic defect to where she could basically not read people or be telepathic, but have motor control of somebody else temporarily, felt forced, and it's like, well, that's going to come out at a key point.
It seemed to be that when she tried to sense their emotions, she accidentally accentuated them. So if they were a little upset or a little nervous, she made them very agitated. Or in the case of the scene you're referring to, if they're a little homicidal and a little angry, she can make them that much angrier. And if somebody's just planted the thought in their mind of, you really want to cut this rope and free me, she can accentuate that impulse somehow.
I read it as actually taking over the motor control system of the nervous system.
Interesting. Okay.
But that's another case where you had a very different read on it than I did, and neither of us has enough information to know if either of us is right.
Yeah, because we saw it twice, and there was no one pulled her aside to talk with her about it or to say, hey, it's not cool to do it to your own crewmate.
Or to explain it to the other guy afterwards, whatever.
Yeah.
That whole scene was, they've known each other for a while, yet they don't know this about each other. That's odd. And it felt like it was telegraphing and was a later part of the plot. Much like when Chekhov and his great-great-granddaughter or whatever, who's now a cadet in Starfleet, are at the park or whatever it was. And there's the, oh, there was this thing of, you know, at class of, would you sacrifice yourself? And I'm like, well, that doesn't bode well for one of the two.
Yeah.
And sure enough, and again, when that panned out, it felt excessive. It felt forced.
It felt very Star Wars.
There were a lot, yes. That one in particular, but there were a lot of things here that felt very Star Wars.
Well, and to the point you are making, it's very hard when you're writing to foreshadow instead of telegraphing. It's a very fine line to walk.
Absolutely. But that was one where I felt there were a number of times that heavy on exposition, blatant telegraphing, but it was also going to your comment about Star Wars versus Star Trek. One of the members of the crew had a face mask thing that we never see them outside of. So an environmental suit, presumably. And it was always speaking alien gibberish, despite their, you know, translating devices in the Federation. But that face mask thing looked very much like what was worn by, I guess it was Leia or Lando. I forget who it was in the Jabba the Hutt scene in the third movie. I think it was Lando. You know, again, kind of the protruding, you know, part in front of the mouth or whatever. It looked like it should have been in a Star Wars fan film or film versus a Star Trek one.
Yeah.
And there were a number of times we got things of that nature where, I mean, none of the ships, aside from the USS Archer, looked like I would expect a Federation ship of any era to look like.
Yeah.
So, and it's not that they looked bad.
No, no.
But a lot of the ships, almost both the alien ships of this new race and the Icarus, reminded me more of Firefly than of anything Trek.
Yeah.
And I don't mean that as a judgment, oh, they got it wrong or anything of the sort, so much as I have certain expectations of what a classic Federation design sense is going to be. And certainly they were trying to push the boundaries, trying to go in some other directions. I applaud that. I respect that.
When the Icarus had a very, I want to say a very rectangular cockpit. And when I think Star Trek, I think very rounded cockpit. And
those are the sorts of things.
It's a stupid little, I expect a circular bridge.
Well, it had on the top of it a very, because they have this one shot of the ship where they pull out, and it's like they're pulling out from the bridge. But it's a round kind of a thing that almost looks like a washer was placed on top of the ship or something weird. It felt like it was a plastic button versus the bridge. But then you pull out, and there's kind of, I think in front, if I'm remembering correctly, kind of the two parts that jut forward, and again, not the oval or the round mm-hmm. aspect. Then as you look at the ship's, the bottom part of the ship, there's this one spot where it's got a vent and all of these kind of cylindrical red things, like they're torpedo tubes, or I don't know what they are. Again, not classic Trek.
Well, the Archer's Bridge was very classic Trek to me, except that the two guys in front, Khan and Ops, I think they were in easy chairs and recliners. And they were just...
I thought they were in loungers. I was expecting somebody to ask, so what happened in your childhood? The way those guys were shot was very off-putting and...
They were never sitting up straight, tense, not even in the fire photon torpedo scenes.
Well, we never once got a shot of them hitting buttons or whatever.
Yeah. And I don't know what decision process led to that. But when you're in this intense action scene, and Korn Nemec was doing really good with a lot of those.
Yes, I think he has done better stuff, notably on Stargate.
True.
But he, again,
but good. He was fun to see him. He was right there in it. And then they cut to the guy who's just kind of leaned back going, uh-huh, I got that fire button.
His Khan and Ops, I would spaced, personally. I was not impressed with them. The, person behind him, the girl.
The security officer.
She was good.
She was.
I was pleased with how she was used.
And she did really well when she beamed down to Starfleet to Chekhov's office.
That, and there were a couple of times where, you know, the ship's about to go across the equivalent of the neutral zone sort of border. Mm-hmm. And she's like, Captain! You know, and there was mm-hmm. a good back and forth between her and Nemec.
Yeah. I thought
she was one of the better actresses. The one who played the captain of the Icarus, who I guess is the daughter of Khan Noonien Sung.
Yeah.
She was good.
Yeah.
And we'd seen her at Comic-Con.
Mm-hmm.
The Beta Zed, good but not great. Gary Graham was good. I just didn't really like his character.
It took me a while to get a handle on his character.
Yeah.
And a lot of that was the writing. You know,
if you're going to do a film like this, spend the time on the writing and get it out there to a select group and have them rip it to shreds because it's worth spending the extra time on the writing.
Yeah. Well, I guess I should pause and say I did not dislike this film. I just saw so many places where it could have been better.
Yes. I mean, I didn't dislike it, but I don't have the level of respect for it that I have for, like, Of Gods and Men.
Yeah.
That one, I thought, wow, that was... It's a fan film. Is it, you know, Oscar award-winning stuff? No, but I thought they gave the characters and the actors a lot to work with.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it felt classic Trek.
Mm-hmm.
It felt like it had some meat to it. I never felt, geez, you know, just hand me the exposition and be done with it.
Yeah.
Whereas that here, there are a couple of scenes where it's like the thing comes to a screeching halt for about half a minute or maybe less. It just felt longer of clear exposition of let me tell you my backstory.
Mm-hmm.
It would have been more interesting to have them actually read their resume almost.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
and part of the awkwardness of that is, and you and I have discussed this off podcast in terms of when we will recommend a show to one another,
mm-hmm.
and we've commented, you know, one of our most common comments to one another when we recommend a show is the pilot is when such and such a character is new to the team.
It's a common writing technique.
It is. And that's what this lacked. All of these characters on the Icarus had allegedly known one another a long time.
But
they brought in the Cardassian.
The Cardassian never acted in that role.
And
he should have.
He didn't really interact with people. He didn't get used in a manner that would help us meet people and discover things.
Now, I believe and I could be wrong about this, but I think the Cardassian was Vic Montoya, who plays Kirk on one of the other...
I think you got his last name wrong, but I know who you mean.
I think I got it totally butchered.
Okay. But, as long as we're in agreement.
I forget what it is, but... He plays Kirk on Star Trek Continues, I think it is.
Okay.
And also has done a ton of voice work for anime.
Okay.
Good actor. So they had somebody
mm-hmm.
that really could have done well with that kind of, you know, introductory role or, you know, vantage point of the audience character.
They had both the character and the actor, if you will. And it wasn't
failed to use it in the writing.
Yeah.
Because that character got used as basically, oh, there's a Bajoran, so let's have the Bajoran yell at the Cardassian kind of a thing.
Well, and he is someone who met the captain, or the person who will serve as captain, in prison, and is someone who, no matter what, has her back.
Well, and we got a little of that in, we were told it, but we'd seen enough to buy it. So that didn't feel like forced exposition. But going back to something that they left out, if you had never really watched Deep Space Nine, why Bajoran, with the fact that the one guy was a Bajoran, lost.
Yes.
You might have picked on it from Roe, from Next Generation, but why the Bajorans and the Cardassians don't get along.
They have one throwaway line of dialogue about it. His people killed millions of my people. Isn't that enough?
Yeah.
For what started a fight.
It was one that the writing could have and should have been better. I was expecting it to, because the whole thing has also got a plot that's very classic original Trek. There are these portals, somebody used them wrong, it blew up a planet, they're getting revenge by blowing up other planets and stuff like this. We never really get the full story as to how this whole problem started. The way it resolved just seemed to be a wave the hands and it's gone. And
I don't feel we, and it's definitely my perspective and it may even be wrong, but I don't feel we saved anyone.
Well, instead of Earth getting destroyed, they destroy this other planet.
Yeah.
You know, quid pro quo or some such. I was expecting the device to get shunted back in time 300 years to when the race said this is when it came and destroyed our planet.
And that came from the Federation.
Yeah. And the captain points out that that's before the Federation existed. Oh, you doubt my story. Well, yes, actually I do. You know, that's one where I think the plot could have been tighter. I think the writing could have been tighter. All of that having been said, it had its moments.
Yeah, and, you know, the writing could have been tighter, etc. When the captain gets recruited for this, she has one condition on recruitment. Cardassian comes with me. And one basic demand of payment.
Well, that's not so much it's a demand of payment, but that's the lure Tuvok gives.
Yes.
I will tell you this if you do this for me.
Yes. And she does.
She's ready to kill him to get the information.
Yes.
And she never gets it.
Yeah. And that, to me, that's a pet peeve at the end of it. And where I was saying, I wish they'd done things differently at the end, whether or not you view this as standalone or a pilot.
Again, I view it very much as a pilot, but...
But even still, I think he should have at least handed her something.
Absolutely. As promised, here's your data crystal or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, I am fulfilling my information.
Tuvok doesn't break promises.
Well, and he should have said, and if you continue to work with us, we will continue to help you pursue this.
Yeah.
You know, it was typically in a pilot episode of a Trek type show or others. Introduce all the crew, gather the crew, have a mission, get to know them. And I left this feeling there were a couple of members of the crew I didn't know.
Well, there were two people we didn't see in the final shot as we fly off into space.
The ones that have been hanging out with Chekhov the whole time that he says are adding to the crew. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
But I mean, at the end, Fixer, I felt like that to me was like the butler did it. And I'm like, wait, they had a butler?
Yeah.
You know, we'd seen him, but I'd never really gotten a grasp for him. The name Fixer just seemed so on the nose. Well, he's the engineer.
Yeah.
You know, that I felt they never really gave any characterization on him until the very end. And then it's kind of silver plattered. But even so, it felt more organic and less expository, although it was clear exposition, than other stuff. And also had been foreshadowed, but not necessarily telegraphed. I was expecting that what happened with or the explanation for Fixer was going to be the explanation for the person in the environment suit. And the person in the environment suit don't know the name and really don't know anything about the character.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
So,
well, the other thing to me is coming out of a pilot for a Star Trek show, usually we're going to boldly go forward. We're going to explore, be it culture or places.
There's a clear mandate. Either we're on a 5-year mission, we're going exploring, we're trying to get back to the Federation.
But it's a positive mandate.
Yes.
And I don't feel this left me with a positive mandate.
It left with a very ambiguous, there are threats that we need to deal with. We're not quite sure what they are.
And they're within the Federation.
They're within the Federation,
We don't trust our own people.
Well, this is very much the along the lines of like a Section 31 kind of a deal.
Yeah.
The covert stuff, there are conspiracies. And the way the ships looked, the way the environments were and stuff, were more messy, Star Wars-y, Firefly-y. Than clean, positive, this is a bright, shiny future of Star Trek.
Mm-hmm.
So I think everything we saw visually kind of underscored the it's not as positive or clean as...
We had more intense fight scenes than typical Star Trek. More Star Wars-ish fight scenes. Even the music was more standard sci-fi fare with a bit more of the Star Wars drama to it.
Yeah, more action-y.
Yeah. Versus Star Trek usually has, I don't want to say lighthearted, but kind of that more upbeat rhythm to their music.
There was also some profanity in it. Not much, but once or twice.
Mm-hmm.
Again, wouldn't get that in a Trek film.
Mm-hmm.
And with the Axanar production, and we'll talk about that later, Paramount and CBS are really kind of asserting their ownership over Trek.
Mm-hmm.
And while this had a lot of Star Trek actors and stuff involved, imparting on it a degree of legitimacy, certainly of Gods and Men had that.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, it felt more legitimate just because of the nature of the story.
Mm-hmm.
It felt more in that universe. So I can definitely see where the property owners feel the need to, hey, wait a sec.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this isn't the tone and style we want for Star Trek. We don't want necessarily, maybe they do or don't, but want the profanity in it. You know, And this was very clear, as with all the fan films, hey, we don't own it, we're just fans, etc.
Well, my understanding is that with the Axanar stuff, Paramount and CBS and the owners of the copyrights are now being challenged to define Star Trek.
Well, here we've got 80, 90 minute, you know, Renegades film here. Two more episodes on the way.
Mm-hmm.
So this is not just hey, we did one just because we thought it was fun.
Mm-hmm.
It's we're trying to make this an ongoing concern.
Mm-hmm.
And that's cool, I'm all for it. I love Star Trek, but I can see where the property owners are like, oh, wait a sec.
Yeah,
you said you were just kind of driving on by, you're setting up camp here.
Yeah.
And I can't fault the property owners for staking their claim and stuff. The fact they've got to define Star Trek to me just boggles the mind.
I'll be endlessly curious to see what comes out as a definition of Star Trek.
There are some things that I think are evocative of Star Trek, yet clearly not Star Trek. I would go with Gene Roddenberry's Andromeda series.
Mm.
You've got a Federation-like thing. You've got a Kirk-like figure. You've, you know, this, that, and the other. A race that's allegorical to, you know, either the Klingons or the Vulcans, or kind of a mix between. Whereas here, even if you hadn't named Chekhov, Tuvok, and a few others, it was really right on the fence between is it Trek or not. We didn't see the beam in and out often, but if you had renamed the Federation, renamed some of the characters, changed the outfits, you could have done this just as a sci-fi movie of the week kind of thing. And I probably would have liked it a little better.
Mm.
Because I wouldn't have had some of the baggage of Star Trek going into it.
Yeah.
The not ending on a positive note, things like that might not have bothered me.
Mm-hmm.
While they, really, the only thing you would have had to change was the Archer.
Mm.
That was the parts where the look of it, the feel of it, very Trek.
Mm-hmm.
Everything else, just sci-fi.
Well, and the Archer really had the Enterprise's silhouette.
Well, again, the outside of the ship, the inside of the ship.
Yeah.
You know, that.
Stem to stern, it was Trek in a lot of ways.
But it was just about the only part.
Mm-hmm.
Even the stuff at the Academy, you could have just renamed that to something else.
Yeah.
And it wouldn't have taken much to de-trekify it.
Yeah.
Whereas, and I guess that's part of why I didn't like Renegades as much as Gods and Men, or of Gods and Men, whatever. Because that one just oozed Star Trek out of it in a very cool way.
Yes.
You know, not only having, you know, a lot of actors both reprising roles and doing other roles and stuff, but it felt true to the nature of Star Trek.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping the next two parts of Renegades they're going to do get more into that mindset.
Mm-hmm.
But this is one of the many things where it's, they're doing Kickstarters, they're doing Indiegogos, they're going funding round after funding round. I have no idea when we'll ever see the next two.
That's a good point.
And there have been one or two others. There's a Captain Pike one that I've pledged for. I don't know when or if that's going to get done, or if it's a... Did I pledge for the whole thing, or did I pledge for like maybe the first 15-minute part of it? Or it gets a little confusing in that respect.
Yeah.
They go back to the well, and it should just be, hey, this is the funding for it. And I know that's unrealistic, but...
But it would be nice.
Be more understandable.
Yeah.
So we've got one or two more things we're going to watch, and we'll be back after that.
Yep.
So we have also watched Star Trek Continues episode 3, I believe. Fairest of Them All. This is on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
Easy to search for. I actually watched it a little while ago. You watched it just today? Okay. And it's a really cool concept because what they're doing is continuing essentially what happened next on an episode.
Mm.
So this particular one takes place at the end of Mirror Mirror. They redo that last scene with the Kirk we know and love talking to the mirror Spock and beaming out.
And he gives a really great inspirational speech.
Well, that's from Mirror Mirror.
Yeah.
And I've seen on YouTube somewhere, oddly enough, not on their channel, though, where the two scenes are side by side and the blocking is pretty close.
Mm.
It's not exact, but I mean, somebody's going to gesture a little off to the right versus, you know, somebody else. But instead of in Mirror Mirror, where we then follow Kirk and company back to the real Enterprise, here we stay with Mirror Spock as the others beam back.
Mm-hmm.
And then how does that Kirk have to, you know, deal with the other, the non-Mirror Universe Kirk having corrupted his crew?
Yeah, and I'd say it's 50-50 in terms of how does he deal with it and how does Spock deal with having been influenced.
Very much what would happen next on that ship, which I love the concept. The actors, this had, and I'm going to get the name wrong, Vic Montanea or something like that.
Magnogia? I don't know.
To look it up.
And put it in the show notes.
Or you can just, actually, what I would recommend, go to YouTube, look for Star Trek Continues Episode 3, Fairest of Them All.
Yeah.
This is worth watching.
It is. It's a full 40-minute episode. They don't skimp. They put in fade to black, come back out for commercial breaks.
It's like you're watching a classic Trek show.
Yeah.
Different actors. The guy that's one of the main guys who plays Kirk. Vic has done a lot of voiceover work for anime and does a good Kirk.
Yeah, he does.
It's not Shatner, but it's not that far off.
Yeah.
And they have recreated the Enterprise.
Yeah.
It feels visually like they stepped back into the 60s and just, hey, they're done for the day. We're going to sneak in and go shoot another episode.
Yeah.
I believe it's James Doohan's son that plays Scotty.
That would make sense.
Grant Imahara from Mythbusters is Sulu.
Mm.
They've had a few different people over, I think, the episodes as McCoy. And the guy they have for Spock, I'm not going to say looks just like him because he doesn't, but does a good job in the role and more or less fits the part.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if they'd gotten some, you know, Samoan or something, some really big stocky guy, you know, looks like a, you know, sumo wrestler. It's like, nah, I don't think so. This guy, skinny, tall enough, you know, and does the mannerisms. He is evocative of Spock.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're not looking at Leonard Nimoy and stuff, but you know, it fits well enough.
Mm-hmm.
And they've got such an attention to detail on the sound effects, on the visuals, on the sets.
Well, and a well thought out script.
Well, I mean, you've got everything to visually, aside from the actors, feel like you're there.
Yeah.
That you can forgive the actors because they're close enough. And I don't mean forgive because they're not as good. Now, granted, Leonard Nimoy, a few of these others are phenomenal actors. They've got good people.
But you just kind of feel like your eyes are a little out of focus, and that's why you aren't seeing the face you expect to see.
Yeah. You know, the intonations, the exact mannerisms, maybe a little off. But it's like just if they had just cast somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
The writing, I mean, that to me is where this, in addition to the impeccable set dressing and attention to detail, all of that, mm-hmm. the writing is just top notch.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just, well, let's do a sequel, let's do What Happens Next. No, they thought it through.
Yeah.
It's solid. It's mm-hmm. got the pacing that feels like mm-hmm. the original series.
Well, the Mirror Universe was a very violent,
mm-hmm.
very hostile universe. And when Spock does finally end up with leading a mutiny, basically, and he's going against some of his fellow crew members, and they're firing at each other, and the guys fighting against him look at each other, and they're like, their weapons are on stun. What the? And he calls back, we don't want to kill our own people. That's not what this is about.
Yeah. We want to change that part of this
yeah.
society.
Yeah.
You know, there's... I also love the bit where Kirk has basically said, okay, let's get Sulu up here and fly out. And Spock's gently reminding him, you know, after having him in the agonizer booth for a while, this is a very, you know, forgiving attitude.
Yeah.
And just watching that Kirk kind of squirm is, what has this other Kirk done to my ship? And
uh-huh.
It was a ton of fun. And it comes down to these people that are on screen behind it clearly love the original series
mm-hmm.
and do their homework and didn't just, hey, let's throw something together. I think they went through some very serious due diligence on, is this a really top-notch script?
Yeah.
Now, I haven't watched the other episodes they've done, so maybe this is just a fluke. I don't think so.
When I really liked when Spock ends up down in Kirk's quarters with the girlfriend,
mm-hmm.
and she's showing him the device that could hurt people, etc.
The
Tantalus
field with the yeah.
Yeah, and he's saying, you know, you don't make change by doing what failed before. You make change by doing things differently.
Mm-hmm.
And she turns to him and asks, can you send me where the other Kirk went? And it's just that she's come to realize almost no matter how much change we start making,
we're still coming from a not so great place.
And that other person was such a better person.
Yeah. It comes down to other things we've seen might have benefited from, you know, better effects or better set or whatever. This one, though, just like I said, nailed the look of it.
Mm-hmm.
And the feel of it.
Yeah.
The things the characters were saying felt like they would have come from the same writers back in the original series days. And as far as, I mean, to me, this is something that, going back to our comments that we made at the end of the Renegades segment of this, of Paramount and CBS kind of needing to assert their ownership, I don't know if I were in their position how I would feel about Star Trek Continues.
Mm.
Is it portraying Trek the way Trek should be portrayed? Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it actually is filling a void there, because we haven't gotten any original series episodes in, what, 47 years?
Yeah.
Probably the entire lifetime of most of those actors. But it's also one that is so following in the footsteps, so clearly Trek, that I could see where the property owners would be like, well, wait a sec, this is getting a little confusing.
Well, and you know, going back to that other conversation and talking about both the writing and the show don't tell aspects, mm-hmm. you know, one of the things I loved about this episode, and I nearly rewound just to have that moment again, was the opening credits with the voiceover.
I love the opening credits bit because they recreate everything down to the opening credits. And they've got the font, it's different actor names.
But in this one, they redid the 5-year mission bit.
Yes, for the
Mirror Universe.
Mirror Universe one.
And it's fantastic because, I mean, technically, okay, it's a monologue. You could claim it's telling you, but really it's a character talking. So I'm going to give it a showing. It's showing you what this universe is.
It's contrasting the typical spiel that Kirk gives with what would that spiel have been in this universe.
Yes.
And they nailed it. And again, that comes down to, one, that's fun to do.
Oh, yeah.
I thought that was a fun thing, a tweak for them to make. But two, they understood Classic Trek and the Mirror Universe well enough to do something that as I'm watching it, I'm like, yeah, this is it.
Yeah.
And it was similar to what they did in Enterprise when they did the Mirror Universe episodes, where the opening credits there typically were of, you know, how we got into space and so forth, and then the Federation gets built. But the equivalent in the Mirror Universe, nuclear war happens or whatever, this goes south,
Yeah.
So the idea had been done before differently elsewhere, but it fit naturally here.
Well, and it gave you this immediate grounding in case you've forgotten what the Mirror Universe's culture is.
Well, and that's why I like that opening scene. This is the scene you remember from Mirror Mirror.
Yes.
Boom. We're continuing from here.
Yes.
And the actors, again, really, the guy who's doing Kirk there is able to do a really good classic Shatner.
Mm-hmm.
Without it seeming like he's impersonating Shatner.
Yes.
Or riffing. It's just he makes it his own.
Yeah.
You know? And the fact this guy hasn't, as far as I know, done anything in, you know, Hollywood or whatever beyond just not just the voiceover stuff for anime. Because my understanding, and I'd have to double check on IMDb, this guy's done like a ton of that. Mm. Like, he's one of the go-to actors for it. But the fact that I don't recall seeing him on live action television or whatnot astounds me. Because he's doing a great job. He's got the nuances. He's got kind of the twinkle in the eye Kirk has at times. And the interplay with Spock and McCoy and whatnot. It captures the fun of the original Trek. Whereas Grant Imahara, who I think does a good Sulu, at times feels like he is doing Sulu. He's impersonating. He's channeling.
Yeah.
For that matter, I felt that way at times with Carl Urban as McCoy in the movies.
I'll agree there.
So, James Doohan's son, who's playing Scotty here, family resemblance. Hmm. He knows how his dad played Scotty. He's not the actor his father is.
No, but he's got the voice.
He's got the voice. It sounds like Scotty. It looks like Scotty.
I had my head turned away from the computer screen it was playing on to glance at an email when he first came on. And so I heard the voice and I did double take and looked over with the, wait a sec. Clearly I should be glued to the screen because I'm missing something.
To me, that's a cool Easter egg homage and way that he can kind of pay tribute to what his father has done.
Mm.
I mean, Scotty is, in terms of cultural influence, has got to have put more people on the whole STEM path of science, technology, electronics, mathematics, whatever the hell it stands for, than almost any other Trek actor, or really almost any other actor. Shy of maybe 3 or 4 others I could think of. You know, Richard Dean Anderson from MacGyver and a few things like that or whatever. But Scotty is just the engineer who can fix anything.
Yeah.
So having the actor's son, you know, continuing on that tradition and stuff, I think is just really cool.
Yeah, I agree.
And the acting, fits the time period. It fits the style of the original series. As does, again, the camera work, the lighting. And I know some people have, well, why try to recreate the lighting of 50 years ago? Because that's what this show is.
Yeah.
You know, there's a certain amount of, if they had put their mind to doing a Next Generation show, which could be fun, or if people of equal talent did that, then you would have had, I would imagine, some episodes set early in the first season that would have had the more dramatic lighting, the hard shadows. Then you get to the later stuff. I mean, if somebody wants to recreate the tone, the style, the look, the feel, and get you into that universe, I mean, clearly they've shown it's doable.
Yeah.
Now, I'd love for somebody to go do that and then cross over with this group. You know, there'd be some fun stuff. But this really just felt like you could toss it onto a collection of episodes of the original series, and if somebody was essentially face blind, and couldn't and just didn't realize it was a different actor, it's like, yeah, it's just another episode.
Yeah,
and I mean that in a very good way.
Yeah, it was very well done.
So that one, I totally recommend watching. I want to see what else this group does. I know they've got a few other episodes they've done that I haven't watched, and they're continuing to produce more.
Very cool.
And I've watched one or two of the tour of the set construction and whatnot, and the effort they've gone to recreate the classic Enterprise. I mean, that's something that if they don't at some point open that up for tours and stuff, they really should.
That'd be cool.
I mean, that would be something at a reasonable price I would consider maybe, you know, kicking in for one of their Kickstarters or Indiegogos or whatever. I think they've got an Indiegogo campaign going on now.
Interesting.
Because they had done Kirk starters before.
Nice.
And now they're Indiegogoing boldly into the future or some such.
Nice.
Again, check out Star Trek Continues on YouTube. If you're into the original series Trek, I think it's fantastic from what I've seen.
I enjoyed the episode immensely. I'll probably be checking out more of the episodes.
Yeah. That it for this one?
That's it.
We have just finished watching Prelude to Axanar, or Star Trek Axanar, Prelude to Axanar might be its full title. It is a 20-minute film that's kind of a teaser, I guess, or whatever, the first part of Axanar.
It seemed to be sort of a documentary about what happened at Axanar and why did Axanar happen. It's a teaser to get you to want to watch a film about Axanar is how I took it.
I'm unclear if the full film is going to be in this documentary style.
I hope not.
I don't know. It actually worked pretty well for me after I got used to it.
But it worked well for me for 20 minutes. I don't think I'd enjoy 80 or 90 minutes of it.
Basic premise of this for the listeners is Garth Vizar is a legendary captain and stuff. This is kind of his story. So it takes place after Enterprise, before original series, and really the war between the Klingons and the Federation and such. And the way this 20-minute thing takes place is as if it's like on a History Channel, Discovery Channel kind of documentary thing. And you've got shots of footage of the quote-unquote actual events or whatever. And then you've also got just interviews, one-on-one interview, or just one, not one-on-one, but just the person being interviewed in like an empty stage facing off to the side with, you know, as if you've just gone up to a starbase to go interview him for a bit. And what I noticed, and I don't know if it was intentional or not, most of the people being interviewed were sitting on the left side facing to the right, except for Karn, the big Klingon battle commander, and Garth.
And the lady, Sonya.
You're right. The people who were in the battles.
Yeah. It's a good point.
So I don't know if that was intentional or not, but the guy doing the voiceover had the voice of that kind of a
narrator
thing that you would expect for, you know, one of the real crime police procedural sort of shows or what have you.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you had top ranking Romulan giving the Romulan, I don't want to say version of events, but the Romulan role of events. You had a top ranking.
It was actually the Vulcan, if you're thinking.
Sorry, you're right, Vulcan. The pointed ears got me.
Yes.
Vulcan. But then we also had two Federation top-ranking officials giving kind of a, and here's what's happening on the Federation side of events.
It's clearly after the fact, but they're recounting the events, you know, for posterity or whatever for the documentary. And the Vulcan ambassador is Gary Graham, reprising his role from Enterprise. We've got Tony Todd as Ramirez, who was kind of the admiral, I guess, of all of Starfleet at the time. We've got J.G. Hertzler as one of the other top-ranking Federation people. We've got Kate Vernon was playing one of the captains for the Federation side.
And then Richard Hatch.
And then Richard Hatch was playing the lead Klingon, Karn. Everybody involved, with one exception, the guy playing Garth of Izar, Alec Peters, who is the writer of this, is somebody who has done TV, movie work, etc. I mean, these are quality actors. And it really shows. I mean, they did a great job. Now, a lot of it's just sitting down and saying, yeah, they had three plans, and one of them was bad, and the other was this, and the other was just crazy.
It's the funny thing of, it doesn't look like acting, but it is.
Exactly. It felt very natural.
Yeah. And it was remarkable in that sense.
It felt very Trek.
And very in character. The only aspect of it that to me wasn't what I classically think of as Trek is that this was all about war. This was all about fighting, all about war.
I agree with you. I think the counterpoint to that is Deep Space Nine, the later seasons.
True.
That were all about war.
True.
So it falls into the kind of that vein. So it's not out of the Trek stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It feels very canonical.
Yes.
The ships all look very either Klingon or Federation or what have you.
And this is all leading up to the building of the Enterprise we know and love from the original series.
They're talking about how the Federation has this new ship they've got to get out there. We go past the shipyard and we see the NCC 1701 on it and such. Mm-hmm. They've talked about the previous Ares class and such.
Mm-hmm.
So everything looks exactly what you would expect out of a theatrical Star Trek film.
Yeah.
And I think that is one of the two ways they've gotten themselves into trouble.
Mm.
Because despite at the end saying, hey, this is all owned by CBS and Paramount and, you know, they don't have anything to do with this, whatever. They have gotten sued.
Yeah.
With you've crossed a line.
Yeah.
And the two lines they crossed, the unimportant one, I think, was quality.
Mm.
Because the other things we've seen of gods and men was good, but not, geez, I think I'm sitting in the theater, kind of movie theater, you know, top notch. It's very good for a fan film.
Yeah.
A lot of fun. Renegades, I thought, was frankly a little shaky on the quality side. Mm. Okay, it was decent for fan film, but not something like you're thinking, I've just watched a Paramount film or you know, a big movie, a Hollywood movie type. And I think where Star Trek Continues really excelled was nailing the style of 1960s television.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas this pretty much nailed the style of modern Star Trek films.
Yeah.
So it's one that just looking at it, if you didn't know it was a fan film, you wouldn't know it was a fan film.
Yeah.
But I think the other place where they kind of crossed a very serious line, in my opinion, and I am not, you know, an intellectual property lawyer or anything remotely like that. I'm just a fan of these films.
But this is why you're worried on their behalf.
Yes. They've basically set up a studio and they're planning on doing lots of films like this. So it's not just, hey, we're doing a film. We're setting up for this to pretty much be their livelihood.
Yeah. Well, and it's a studio that others can rent access to, etc.
Yes.
And that's an uneasy feeling in terms of it implies it could generate a profit. And these fan films are meant, I'm sorry to say, to break even. Because if you make a profit off someone else's intellectual property, that's when you've crossed a line.
Well, Alec Peters, I think, was involved in Star Trek Phase 2, which is another web thing. I've seen one of the episodes that had Walter Koenig in it reprising Chekhov. There's another one that's got George Takei doing Sulu and such. And as I recall, they were good.
Mm-hmm.
I would say just a hair below, say, Star Trek Continues. Again, what they were setting out to do of continuing the original stuff, they did great. That kind of has the blessing to keep going.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Axanar doesn't. And where do you draw the line as an IP holder of saying, these people are living off of this, therefore making personal money, even if the project doesn't make money.
Yeah.
And the minute you've got somebody basically renting a production studio, rebuilding one of your sets so they can film new episodes of your property, it was okay in the past, but now it's not. It's a very gray area for me.
Well, yeah, and they're not giving you money to license the name Star Trek, which they're using.
That's where I really think CBS and Paramount missed the boat. If I saw something like this, I would say, okay, we can't just have people running amok doing this. I get it.
Mm-hmm.
But damn, hire them.
Yes, yes.
Find some, even if you don't hire them flat out, some sort of joint venture sort of a thing where you maintain control over the property, but other people can actually go do it in a way that's mutually beneficial.
Well, and in a lot of ways, the writing on this one was very good Trek in terms of having a good understanding of how the Vulcans speak and approach things and think about things versus the Klingons versus the humans.
The only place I thought the writing on this fell down, and where if I was the property owner of Star Trek, I would say, hey, no, this is wrong.
She should have done it in Klingon. If you're on the line, I think you're on.
Yes. Garth of Izar is basically saying, yeah, that's what the Klingon calls me. They could have called me worse. Cut to the female captain, and I was called blah, 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 with some profanity in there.
Hmm. If she had simply said it in Klingon.
And then said, I'm too polite to translate.
Yes. Yes.
There are many ways they could have handled that I think would have been classier and still gotten the point across.
Well, and quite frankly, the Klingon would have sounded worse because of the guttural, harsh nature of the Klingon language.
Mm-hmm. And again, there's a way you could phrase, and that can't be translated. Or if it can, you know, I don't know the anatomy well enough, you know, the medical terminology well enough.
Yeah, exactly.
I was disappointed with it, and that was just a 10-second line.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you cut the one thing out, and boom, it could pass as legitimate track. And again, quality-wise, I think that's where Paramount and CBS are like, hey, wait a sec.
Yeah.
Because, again, the writing on this, top-notch. Acting on this, they got veteran Trek people, sometimes in their roles, other times different roles, top-notch.
Mm-hmm.
The effects were stellar.
Mm-hmm.
Even just the interview scenes, it's like, okay, how hard is that? You get somebody in a soundstage. The background, Starfields, whatever. I mean, the green screening was flawless.
Yeah, yeah. They did some really nice lighting on, especially Tony Todd, during one of the interviews.
The recreation of the Archer Arena.
Yes.
Which I think we'd seen in the end of Enterprise.
Yeah.
Well done.
To me, some of their close-ups were a bit extreme. There were a few times when I wish they would have pulled back the camera a little bit.
There was one time they did, and it felt a little awkward when Karn was saying that they'd finally kind of gained respect for the Federation, pull back, and he's like repositioning his half-Batleth or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just, I'm not sure what I was supposed to get out of that.
Well, and I think some of it with the extreme close-ups was basically they had to do less background and less wardrobe by being really tight on head and shoulders.
I think it was less that than if we were to watch more of this style of documentary on real TV. That's what they do to cover the fact it's talking heads.
Interesting.
In other words, I think they shot it the way historical stuff would be shot now.
Interesting. Because there were some shots where it was like you couldn't even see the person's neck. We were so close up.
If they were to do a documentary on like the Gulf War or what led to this, that, or the other, and could get the appropriate high ranking U.S. and Iraqi, you know, whatever people, I could see it being very similar.
Yeah.
Well, granted, not shot on a starbase, of course, but you get the idea.
Details.
But go close up, move the camera a little bit just to cover the fact that this guy's been talking, cut between person to person that's telling the same story to.
Mm-hmm.
Just to make it visually more interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So it felt real in that respect.
Mm-hmm.
And again, this looks like a lot of fun. initially I was a little put off by the documentary style, but as it kept going, it worked.
Mm-hmm.
The choice of narrator, I thought, again, had the right voice.
Yeah.
Good actors and stuff. So would I want to watch another hour or two of this? Yeah, actually, probably.
Yeah.
I think they've kind of put the production on hold pending legal problems.
Sad to say.
And the fact that Paramount and CBS seem to initiate with a lawsuit versus just talking, I get, but a little disappointing. But it's a 50-year-old property that they own and have done great work with at CBS and Paramount and have done well with how they've licensed it.
Yeah.
So people coming and doing it for free, I think they've got a legit, stand there.
It'll be interesting to see how that shakes out.
I think so, because if Axanar gets shut down, what about all of these other productions?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that hurts the Star Trek community.
Mm-hmm.
Both in terms of the actors who've actually been able to do some work on this stuff, and even if they're not making big money on it, it gives them new stuff to talk about or whatever at conventions, and
yeah,
keeps them in, the fan base active.
Yeah.
Some of the people behind the scenes, I think, have worked on some of these things, and just from a fan perspective, it would be a real downer if they kind of just squash that.
Yeah.
Because it's great getting a major motion picture every other year or whatever we've gotten for the last few. But man, I'm really looking forward to next year getting the web series.
Yeah.
Now, the fact that Star Trek's coming back as a TV series and there are these fan films, again, conflict of interest, I get it.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm hoping for a peaceful resolution.
Yeah.
And one that allows for Paramount and CBS to retain ownership and control while facilitating and empowering competent fan films to be done.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see Paramount or CBS going back to the 60s style for the original series like Phase 2 or Continues is done.
Yeah.
So let those people kind of run with that. Give them some guidelines of what they can and can't do. Have it go through an approval process for the scripts or whatever. Treat it like it's an actual licensed thing. And if you want to cap how much they can make or whatever, that's...
Mm-hmm.
Set the rules. But it would be a shame if some of these productions that are frankly really well done just can't happen.
Yeah.
And again, this was another one where they're not just a couple of people in their backyard, shooting in front of a green bed sheet or whatever and chroma keying it out or something. They put some serious time and effort into it because they love the property.
Yeah.
Respect that as best the property holder can. Likewise, they need to respect the property holder.
Agreed.
And kind of work with them, too. So, this is something that I'm pretty sure is up on YouTube. We actually had a copy we'd gotten from the Kickstarter, or?
From the press people.
The press people, that's
they
right.
They sent it to us after the con last year, because we had made contact with them at the panel.
Yeah, we'd seen them at the panel. I gotta say, though, in terms of all the different projects we've looked at, the effects on this one just blew me away.
Mm-hmm.
Again, mm-hmm. the space scenes we saw, the junkyard after the battle math, kind of stuff. It just crazy good.
It's interesting because normally when I see documentaries that have that docudrama
uh-huh.
aspect to them, and you see people acting out these historical scenes, and they usually come up with cheesy dialogue that sounds impossible, and you're sitting there going, how the heck do you even know they said that in that situation? And docudramas typically don't work for me. But the fact that this was taking the feel of a docudrama, and instead of throwing in cheesy, unreal feeling dialogue, they had just these great flyby scenes of the city they're talking about, or flyby, like you say, the destroyed field of ships.
Yeah.
And then we would come in and find out the battle was already over because we could never get there in time. And basically matching images to, I want to say, sort of a trailing voiceover from the interview.
Visuals that support the interview.
Yeah. And it was just beautifully cut together and edited and felt so wonderful in that respect.
And I know this was all scripted out. So one person saying something, the next follows on.
Mm-hmm.
It was written that way. But it felt like something they did separate interviews. They would have cut to this and somebody good at the editing would have strung it together that way.
Yeah.
It felt natural.
Yeah.
And that's a heck of a credit to both the writing and the acting.
Yeah.
And again, the editing, I mean, it's just, this one is, if I were at Paramount saying I'm going to do a new web series, I wouldn't be suing these people.
I'd be hiring them.
I would be hiring them.
Yeah.
Maybe not as the key, you know, top of the food chain type thing, but they love the stuff. They know the stuff. Gosh, let's leverage that.
Yeah, exactly.
So this one, again, I definitely recommend. I recommend Star Trek Continues of Gods and Men. I really enjoyed.
Mm-hmm.
Renegades, if you're a hardcore fan, sure.
Yeah.
If you're a little bit more pressed for time, the other stuff is better.
Yeah. I'll agree with that.
Phase 2, again, it's been a while since I've watched the one or two episodes. I enjoyed it. I would still put Continues probably above it.
Mm.
And I would say probably, again, I would say Of Gods and Men above that. And then Axanar is just, again, top quality in terms of just visual effects as well. Mm-hmm. It's also 20 minutes.
Yes.
So quick and easy to watch. Again, I'm looking forward to both the next Star Trek movie coming out, the new web series coming out, learning what that is going to be about. Is it new timeline? Is it old? And maybe that's what CBS and Paramount do. They're sticking with the new timeline. Or maybe Paramount gets the new timeline, CBS gets the old one, and they you know, the fan films can do this area or whatever, you know? Mm-hmm. But Star Trek is a rich enough universe that there's more than enough to go around. It's nice that Paramount and CBS work well together and that they've, again,
mm-hmm.
licensed it well in comics, computer games, and, you know, elsewhere.
Well, and since we're talking Trek, the books that I enjoyed so much and I recommended to you, Christopher L. Bennett, I think, wrote them.
Mm-hmm.
He went through and kind of researched.
Oh, the Department of Temporal Affairs.
That's it.
Well, again, the Star Trek novels, I've been a fan of those since college.
Yeah. He researched all the time travel in the old series, the Next Generation, etc., and he made a coherent timeline out of it.
Well, one of the things they did at the end of Enterprise, where it was clear they were kind of not getting another season, so they could almost do whatever they wanted with no downside, they tapped into a lot of the novel writers and said, give us a couple episodes.
Yeah.
And that's where we got the Mirror Universe stuff. We've got the Khan's backstory and some stuff like that. Just some great stuff. I mean, the people doing the novels, again, the Department of Temporal Affairs.
Yeah.
Love that stuff. I got into the Trek novels in college, where I guess it was my second year of college. I'd been hanging around with the local comic book store, you know, gang that would get together on Friday nights. And for Christmas, I got some of the novels from some of the people. It was everybody got a name and, you know, give one person something else. And one of the books was Kobayashi Maru for the original Trek.
Mm-hmm.
And it was basically how Kirk and some of the others got through that test in the academy. And how Kirk got through rang true to the character. How Scotty solved his academy, you know, one of his challenges or whatever, very engineering-ish,
mm-hmm.
rang true to him. How Sulu did his thing. And sometimes it was Kobayashi Maru, sometimes it was just some other, well, tell me a story about how you got through this. Because it was, the framing sequence was one of those classic, they're stuck in a, like a shuttlecraft, and
mm-hmm.
as they're waiting to be rescued by the Enterprise, tell a story kind of a deal.
Mm-hmm.
So it was almost a series of short stories, but worked together as a novel. And again, the author, and I forget who the author of that one was, it rang so true that I can't imagine Kirk having any other way that the Shatner Kirk, at least,
yeah.
could have gotten past the Kobayashi Maru test.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, he cheated. We know that from the second film. This is how he cheated.
Yeah.
And again, it's just beautiful. And, you know, I'd been a fan of Trek and stuff. We were getting together on Saturdays at the comic book store when Next Generation was still airing at the time. That's how old I am.
Yeah.
I would have been its second season.
Yeah.
So we were all fans of Trek, and to realize that some of the novels really captured the sensibility of it.
Mm-hmm.
And this was at a time when I had enough free time to read novels. At one point, I was, I think, current on all the pocketbooks for Star Trek, having gone back and gotten them all.
Yeah.
Now, I've since gotten way behind because, you know, I'm working, it's busy. When I was traveling, I had a lot more time to read than I do now. I can't even keep up with my comics right now. But I have tried to keep up on the Department of Temporal Affairs At one point, I was staying current, but that was a number of books ago, with the Peter David kind of offshoot branch.
New Frontiers. Those were good. I enjoyed those.
And if you've got people who really want to do a Trek thing, maybe tap them and say, you know, we're not going to do a New Frontiers thing, but, you know, why don't you talk to Peter David and, you know,
see if
you can get some of these people and go with it.
Yeah.
Maybe you could, maybe you couldn't. I don't know. It just seems like there's some opportunities. But there's plenty of Trek out there to be had. A lot of these fan films are surprisingly fun.
Yeah.
And in some cases, just surprisingly well done. So I think it's worth checking them out.
Agreed.
So anything else? Does that do it?
That does it.
Cool.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.